Vermont Viewpoint is a public affairs program produced and funded by WDEV and the Radio Vermont Group. We welcome listener feedback. Email your comments to vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com.
Good morning. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV. I'm Rick Singeri. We're going to spend this first hour talking about food, baking first, then plant-based meat products. Next hour, we head to one of my favorite Vermont towns, Orwell, for some glass blowing and to learn about a company that makes incredible furnaces for the glassmaking industry. And then we'll finish the day with a half hour of open phones. But to start, let's throw on an apron, get the oven ready, because we're about to learn from a true champion baker. Adam Manette of St. Albans recently competed on the Food Network's Holiday Baking Championship, and he proved to be a very worthy champion indeed. He joins us now. Adam, welcome to Vermont Viewpoint.
Yes, good morning. Thank you very much for having me.
Good morning. Listeners, if you'd like to ask Adam about the show or his baking skills, you can give us a call, 802-244-1777, 877-291-8255, or email vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. First of all, Adam, when you're not showing the world what a brilliant baker you are, what are you doing with yourself?
Well, my full-time job is culinary arts instructor at the Northwest, Technical and Career Center, right next to BFA in St. Albans. So I do that for the week, and then when I'm not baking, I'm usually spending time with my family, my two daughters, and then and wife. We're usually pretty busy out and about, and. Or I'm doing projects around the house, so whether it's a woodworking project or things like that, I'm usually pretty straight out all week. So
yeah. Now, what kind of skills are you teaching the students at the school?
So it's interesting. So this is a pretty comprehensive program. So we cover everything from usually the core foundation is mostly savory cooking. It's not baking. We don't get that into that till, either the second year or the latter half of the year. And we go over foundational cooking. So, cooking methods, dry heat, moisty combination cooking methods, knife skills. You can imagine, 15, 16 kids with knives in their hands for the first time.
They better love you, Adam.
Yeah. And, sanitation. So those are all fundamental things, and the idea is to give kids, that preparation needed to, join the food service and hospitality industry, or continue on to post-secondary and, get more training and then find what they're really interested in. So that's the purpose we serve, to get kids that experience and that hands-on learning and, teach the trade, teach this craft that is cooking. So that's what we do, and it's super fun. We have a lot of great kids here at the Tech Center, and the kids choose these programs. So it's not like a traditional math class. Teacher doesn't go out in the hallway and be like, he's going to know, he's going to see every single student. So we cater to, specific clientele that, have interest in, pursuing, or at least trying to, think about pursuing what this career could look for them.
Well, Adam, when did you realize that you had a knack for cooking and baking?
So I started pretty early when I was 15. I had my first job in a professional kitchen. My brother got me the job once my brother solidified a job in the kitchen, my dad was like, get your brother a job.
That's how it's done.
Yeah. And so, I started doing that, but it wasn't until close to the end of high school and after high school, I started working, at this, little bakery, Edelweiss, for this, the man was, Rolf Labelle, and he was the pastry chef. And the baker there, and he was incredibly knowledgeable, like very, very gifted and talented. And so he ran the bakery, him and his partner, Ken. And it was a great experience. There was a moment where it wasn't work. Like I was going to bed. I was going home thinking about what the next day was going to be. And like, I was excited to go to work. And I think that's, you know, if you could find a job where you have that level of enthusiasm to get it better every day and to do that, I think that's really, yeah, I mean, you can't ask for anything more. So that was the turning point where I was like, okay, like, you know, he inspired me to pursue it. And then again, it was just by chance, you know, it's like, I had a, you know, my girlfriend at the time, now wife, she's the one who applied for me to go to culinary school.
Wow.
Because I was, the irony is that I'm teaching, you know, at a high school, but I was a very, very poor high school student myself. So, the irony is not lost on me. And then, so I, you know, she filled up the application for me to go to school with the New England Culinary Institute, and, had a great experience there. It's a great school. It's unfortunate that it's closed now, but, when I went, it was, you know, a superb school with, you know, great opportunities, and it took advantage of all those opportunities. So yeah, I mean, but that was to get into baking specifically, and that's where I started my career. So, and really focused in on was baking and pastry. And then I later, you know, went back to school for, you know, culinary arts, and then kind of pursued that. So yeah, I've, had opportunities.
You probably didn't start out at Edelweiss making, you know, croissants or perfect pie crust. What did they, like, how did you work up? What did they have you do when you first started there at Edelweiss?
when I first started, I was scooping cookies. So that was my, that was one of the first, like, baking oriented things. And I remember Rolf putting this kettle in front of me with this cookies, and like, it was just, you know, before then, I was like, I mean, I was making like the lunch menu and things like that. And, I wasn't trusted to do, the baking at this point. And, you know, it was, you know, it's one of those things where you have to prove yourself and, you know, and to show, you know, that you're interested. And so I remember he put this big kettle in front of me. I start scooping away cookies and I get all these trays done and I wanted to show him how fast I could do it. He came over to inspect my work and he puts the scoop over the cookie. The cookie batter came out the sides, meaning that it wasn't level, it wasn't a uniform scoop. He threw everything back in that kettle, and he scooped it himself. I didn't touch another cookie for, you know, a while. So he was a stickler for, you know, consistency and also, like, you know, doing his way. It was very much like when your name is on the, you know, the out, you know, on the building, you can do what you want. But until then, you know, it's like it's my way. And, that's the way I learned. And, you know, it was, but, you know, when he would, the moments he would take and share with me were like pearls. And they were, you know, I still say, like, you know, that was one of the, you know, I still, a lot of things I do today is because of what I learned then. But yeah, scooping cookies. And then, you know, there was other instances where I was like, you know, finally getting into, like, you know, maybe being trusted to decorate something or, and then I would, you know, I'd be so excited and nervous at the same time that, you know, I feel like every single time I'd botch it up and he would correct me, and then show me what he would want, done. And, you know, it was one of those things where, I guess, you know, to see, like, when you watch somebody who's a true craftsman, who's really good at what they do, it's inspiring. And, you know, you couldn't help but tell that, you know, he was very good at what he was doing. So, and there was a lot of learning through, like, just watching. Like, I remember, you know, there'd be times where, you know, it might be slow, and I would just watch him, you know, work in the kitchen, whether he was making bread or, you know, making like laminations, you know, for the morning pastries. And, and kids don't, you know, it's like my students, they get right into it. You know, they don't have to wait and watch. So, like, so much of it was just like, for me was observing, but I learned a lot through that. And, so, you know, it's just a different way of teaching for sure.
It's like getting a graduate degree before you really, were ready to run, but you learned, probably picked up so many wonderful things from him. Oh, what a great story.
Yeah.
Adam, what motivated you to apply to be on the Holiday Baking Championship?
Well, that's a funny story too. Nothing. I didn't apply. I had a former student, who they were reaching out looking for, male bakers, And, you know, the former student gave them my name, and then they reached out to, me. They were, you know, I think Food Network probably has like, headhunters that like, you know, scour the internet for like Instagram and like, all sorts of social media looking for, you know, potential, people to be on their shows. And they reached out on, you know, on Instagram, but I'm not really big on social media. and so they finally called, and of course I, you know, they left a message, and I thought it was like a, you know, who knows, like a
right.
marketer or something. So,
sure.
And then the student, he text messaged me. He's like, no, someone's trying to reach out to you to see if you're interested in being on a show. And then they talked more about it. And I was like, yeah, I mean, the timing could work out. So, and then there was after that point, there was an audition piece. So it's not like, oh, we want you on the show. Like you're on. It was like, you had to audition. They had to like, we did a bunch of Zoom meetings and then I had to, you know, bake two items so they could see like, you know, the range or like what I could do within a time frame. And then they didn't let us know that, you know, that I made it on the show till a week, to being on the show. So it was just, you know, it was just like, they're like, oh yeah, we'd love to have you on the show. And I was, cause at that point I kind of put it in the back of my mind. And I was like, oh, it's not going to happen. I was like, that's okay. I was like, that was still cool anyway. So. But when they called me, they're like, yeah, we'd love to have you on the show. And of course it was, you know, it's like, you know, you don't know how to, you know, how you're going to respond or react. And the way she phrased it, I thought like when she called me, I was like, I thought she was offering me my own show. I was like, well, that seems a little advanced, but you know, I was like, sure, why not? I could roll with it.
Well, I think you should have your own show, but, so over how long a span of time was, the series shot?
Two and a half weeks of, in very, very few days off. It was, you know, it's waking up in early in the morning. And then we'd be, you know, around 6 o'clock in the morning and then getting to the studio and then, you know, sometimes not coming home till, you know, back to the hotel, I should say, till like 10:30, 11. So, they can be really, really long, long days. So. There's a lot of filming, and then of course you know it's very, very edited, and you know and not all of it makes it on television. So
you still wearing makeup when you do now? You teach there at hair and makeup you go into the classroom.
Well, because of COVID, you know, we had to apply our own makeup, and you know, of course, I was worried because I didn't want to look like you know Heath Ledger's Joker, you know, yeah. Doing my own makeup. So. but no, it was very simple. Like they had like, we would have these little kits and of course they would walk us through it and apply. And I was just like, applying this so you don't have like a shine with the camera. So,
yeah.
But during when we're in the kitchen, you know, baking, it was just, you know, nobody was applying makeup at that point here. So it was only for the interview. And the judging piece, but and then the judging, you know, it's like it was nerve-wracking enough here. I don't know if makeup concealed too many things. So,
all right, let's take a call. We've got Amanda joining us from Cabot. Hi, Amanda.
Hi, and congratulations. We were watching and rooting for you.
Thank you, Amanda. Thank you.
You're welcome, and thank you for doing it and representing Vermont so nicely. I wondered, actually being on the show, what the most difficult part of it all was, whether it was the actual cooking or the speaking or if there's something we would not even imagine went on when you're filming a show.
Yeah, what was going on there, Adam?
That's a good question. The most difficult thing was definitely the challenges because they were sometimes very obscure. Like, you know, it's, to say someone, oh, make a holiday dessert, or make a dessert and make it holiday, and for it to be delicious and look great, it's like that's not a big ask. But like, there was some of the challenges were like there was a level of the retro desserts, taking like I got an ambrosia salad. I didn't even realize that was a dessert. So I was like, I have to make a dessert out of something that's not really a dessert. So that was. There's no frame of reference for that. Like, you know, it's like you're being creative, but I mean, that was the hardest thing was the best thing about, you know, about that is, like, it's very conducive for creativity. You're in a position where you're forced to be creative. So that's really fun, because sometimes, you know, wherever you're working, you know, you're either doing some of the same stuff over and over again, but in this sense, like, you know, it forced you to really kind of dig deep and try to think of something that you could do to meet the challenge. But yeah, that was the hardest piece, some of the challenges, the bread challenge, you know, turning bread into looking like vegetables. Yeah. I mean, that's not something I do every day.
No?
And then, no. And then even the Kwanzaa challenge, like, you know, I don't know. I think you saw that with a lot of the competitors, like even like the Hanukkah challenge, you know, it's like some people are just, you know, we're not familiar with the holiday. So right. they didn't know how to convey it. And so that was challenging.
Would they give you kind of any time to research, or, you know, when somebody throws you a challenge, you just have to grab things and start baking?
Yeah, we had a couple minutes to like look at the pantry of ingredients. But yeah, so it's like a lot of the things, especially, you know, as we progressed, it just like was just like, okay, here's a challenge, good luck. And you're like, oh
wow.
You're like, okay, and you're like, what am I gonna do? And now the hardest thing is, like, if you didn't have an idea, and like you're like, if you didn't have a direction, what do you do? Like, and how do you meet a challenge when you have no idea, like, what it is. So, and I think that's what I saw, like, going back and watching it, was like how everybody approached this, you know, these challenges so uniquely. No two were the same. I mean, with the exception of, like, I think Jody and I had, like, when we did the postcard challenge, we both did opera cakes, but I think that's only because we both knew that we needed a lot of time for decoration, and we needed a cake that could taste good and then also could be built fairly quickly, given the time frame. And that's the thing. The hardest thing was also the time.
Yeah.
Because, you know, it's like the finale when, you know, it's like for anybody to make a three-tier cake and, you know, the time frame they give, and then cool something, and then fill it and make a filling, and then ice it, and then decorate it. It's just, I mean, that's a lot. So everybody's icing hot cakes, you know. It's like if they're leaning, there's a reason for it. And, you know, it's like given more time, everybody, of course, would knock it out of the park. But, I mean, that's the whole premise of the show, is, like, they want a lot of these things done in a very short time span. So that was also very challenging, working in the time.
The dessert charcuterie that you created might be about the most beautiful edible thing I've ever seen in my entire life. Have you ever, do you create that kind of thing normally? Is that something you've done before?
Oh, you know, it's funny. You know, it's, to me, that's a cookie platter. So I think, you know, I think they play within the realm of trends and, you know, things of that nature. I also think of, like, another term, like mignardise, where you have, like, confections, you have some, you can have, you know, cookies and lots of little small bites.
Yeah.
So it's a way of repackaging it. I mean, obviously, I think the sauces, the accompaniment with the sauces, which kind of made it unique and, again, was a good way to show the range of, you know, the different competitors, because, you know, it's like nobody does the same thing very, very, very rarely.
Yeah.
So everybody's approaching it differently, but it was fun because, you know, there were things that I was hoping I could do, right? You know, there was recipes where, like, oh man, if I get an opportunity and I get to do this recipe, you know, it's like, I know I could do really well. And you're like, if the challenge fits, you know, I'll pull out all the stops. So,
gotcha.
And that was like the thing with the mignardise. I did the almond horns, and that was a homage to, you know, Rolf. And then, of course, you know, stuff that, you know, I've learned since then. So, you know, I wanted to show, like, this progression, and I, you know, and then the other thing too is to not try to keep doing the same thing over and over again. You know, it's like, nobody wants to see, you know, a cookie or, you know, or, like, you know, in six different ways, but, you know, you're still doing a cookie. So, so I don't know. That was my approach to the competition, was to show, you know, as, you know, just the range of, you know, what I can do, and
I hate to say this. We're almost out of time. You probably hate to hear that now. But any thoughts of a bakery of your own?
Absolutely.
Yes.
You know, I think, you know, whether it's a cafe or something like that, I mean, you know, my, you know, I love what I'm doing here at the school, but, you know, my dream, my dream wasn't to be a tech teacher. I mean, you know, I'm fortunate and, you know, grateful that I have the opportunity, but yeah, absolutely in the future. It's just a question of timing. So
Excellent.
Once the timing's right, I'll definitely move in that direction.
Oh, I can't wait. We'll have you back on. Adam Annette of St. Albans, culinary instructor at the Northwest Career and Technical Center and recently winner of the Food Network's Holiday Baking Championship. Adam, congratulations. Thank you so much
Thank you for sharing.
Yeah, it was great having you. Take care. A definite winner. All right, we're going to take a break for a CBS News update. Then we're going to return to learn about Green Slice Foods of Belgium and Bolton. And coming up today at 1 o'clock, we've got the Vermont Conversation with David Goodman. That's followed by 2 hours of The Getaway with Galloping Greg Hooker. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV.
Warren Village is a picture-perfect snow globe this time of year. We invite you to visit us at the almost world-famous Warren store. Come for breakfast, lunch, or après-ski. Have a signature deli sandwich, a hearty soup, or a specialty coffee drink paired with a sweet treat from our incredible bakery. Upstairs is a cornucopia of delightful and unique finds from men's, women's, and children's clothing to gifts, toys, games, jewelry, hats, gloves, and scarves. Best one-stop shopping in Vermont, according to Yankee Magazine. Fun, funky, safe, and friendly. Warren Store, Main Street, Warren Village, and warrenstore.com.
We're back on Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV. Trust me, the idea of a burger made of plants that was supposed to taste like a burger didn't sound great to me until I had one. Then I realized this really was possible. So what about doing the same and making hot dogs, ham, or pepperoni? Leave it to a Vermont-Belgian connection to figure out how to make some of the savory delicacies we crave. Make them vegan, gluten-free, and organic. The company is called Green Slice, and they're based in Bolton. Joining me to tell us their story is Green Slice owner Veronique Beitel. Veronique, welcome to Vermont Viewpoint.
Thank you so much for having me. Good morning, everybody.
Good morning. And listeners, to ask Veronique about the different products that Green Slice makes, you can call us 802-244-1777, 877-291-8255. You can email vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. First of all, Veronique, what is Green Slice?
Green Slice is basically deli slices and veggie dogs all made from organic plants, but look and taste like meat. It's basically to help everybody out that wants to reduce their intake of meat or wants to reduce their intake of processed meats in particular. And that's why I wanted to give like an organic, healthy alternative that everybody could enjoy.
Where did the idea come from? When did the business get started?
It basically started when my daughter was 2 years old, and that's when basically they all start looking for, or mothers start giving them the hot dogs and the lunch meat, the staples of children in their diet. And I decided I didn't want to give those processed meats to my daughter. So for the very first time, I visited this meat alternatives section in the store. And what I found didn't excite me. I didn't like the look, the taste. I also didn't like the ingredients. Everything was heavy, processed soy and gluten. So I decided there has to be another way. And that's basically when the idea of Green Slice was born.
Oh, I love it. Now, what is the connection between Belgium and Bolton?
I'm originally from Belgium, and I actually moved here almost 20 years ago for an internship at Hillshire Farm. I launched their Ultra Thin Deli Slices.
Of course.
And the reason why I came to the U.S. for an internship is my grandfather used to have a slaughterhouse in Belgium. Mm. Now he gave that, passed that on to my cousins, and they realized instead of putting the head of a grinder, the head of a cow in the grinder, let's just put plants in that grinder. And that was back in the 90s, so that original grinder has long been replaced. But basically, that's when I approached them and living in Vermont here saying, hey, let's make something that is truly healthy alternative, because there's a lot of meat alternatives that sometimes I don't think is truly a healthy alternative. It might be tasty, but I wanted to make something that makes you feel good as well about what you're doing for yourself and for the environment. And that's basically where it all started. It's been a long road.
The last
couple of years, basically, people wanted me to ship online, which we weren't set up to do. So I started shipping out of my house. It quickly took over my living room, my dining room. And then we realized it's time for the next step. And that's when we bought a warehouse in Bolton.
Yeah.
That's how we arrived in Bolton.
Yeah. How did you get to Bolton in the first place, to Vermont in the first place?
It was about 11 years ago. My husband and I came here on a ski trip, and we fell in love. And I said, what if we would live where we want to vacation? And I was ready to move a week after that. My husband said, no, let's get our finances in place. But basically, 6 months after our ski trip here in Vermont, we quit our jobs on the same day and drove here, loaded up the animals in the car, and drove here with absolutely nothing lined up. And that was 11 years ago, and that was the best decision we ever made.
Yeah.
We ended up buying an old farmhouse in Richmond. So we've been living in Richmond for the past 11 years, and then I started looking around for a warehouse and found this beautiful warehouse. Well, dilapidated at first, but it's starting to look a little bit pretty. And I found this beautiful warehouse in Bolton, and maybe it might not be the perfect location for trucks to get to, but it's a beautiful location, and it's all about work-life balance for me. So Bolton was just where I lost my heart. So.
I love it. I understand in better weather, you can actually canoe between home and work.
Yes, correct. And I even asked my husband if he could buy like a hovercraft so we could make our way back upstream, but I didn't have to paddle, but not in our budget for now. we'll have to keep plugging away.
I love it. Well, let's talk about Green Slice. Tell us about the products that you are making now.
So the products we make, our focus is deli slices and veggie dogs, and we focus on making them from clean ingredients, and we also wanted to make them allergen-free, so truly everybody could enjoy. So that means that we are not working with soy or gluten like you usually see in meat alternatives. We use peas instead. So the ingredients you'll find in our foods are peas, tomatoes, garlic, onions, carrots, things, or even leeks, things you recognize and can pronounce. So
yeah.
That's basically the main, the basic ingredients. And then we work with a lot of spices just to get that savory taste that you're used from eating meat. So once you put our slices on a sandwich, and definitely a hot dog, most people cannot even tell the difference. And I think that's what it should be about. You shouldn't be looking at it as an alternative. It's just tasty food that you would like to eat. And yeah.
Yeah. And so when you have somebody try these for the first time, like maybe a hot dog, do you let them know what it is before you throw it on a bun, add some mustard and sauerkraut, and have them dig in?
No, that would not be fun. We actually got a bunch of kids. It was actually in the Richmond Park I set up years ago cooking the veggie dogs. And we actually gave a bunch of the veggie dogs just on a toothpick. It was not even on a bun. We just sliced them up and put a bite size on a toothpick and had kids try them. And we said, what do you think of our hot dogs? And they said, they're amazing. And it wasn't until children reached more like the 12-year-old age, then there was a question here and there like, oh, what does this make of? Like sometimes they could notice a difference. But that was just straight on a toothpick with no bun, with no condiments. So that's when I knew I'm onto something. I've got to bring this to the world. It's hard. We're like a bootstrapped approach. I'm 100% owner, so there's no investors yet.
Wow.
But we've taken it far. I think we're now we're sold across 500 stores in the U.S. And we just launched in Shaw. So I think if you go to Shaw, you might have seen our products already in the produce department next to all the other meat alternatives. it's exciting.
Oh, that is exciting. Now, taste is one thing, Veronique, but the consistency of a product like this, you know, it has to be fairly close to the meat product it's mimicking, you know, for people to kind of feel it's close to the same thing. So how do you get that right, the consistency of these meat products?
It's hard. It's and I've also realized that certain people prefer different consistency. So if you're used to eating a bologna, we're hitting that texture really hard. But if you're looking more for like a prosciutto style, that is harder to mimic. We're improving every day. I think our first improvement is always staying true to our ingredients. I think we could improve texture and taste way more, but then you would trade off your organic, clean ingredients, which we're not willing to do. And I think so far people have been very welcoming. We keep on getting great reviews, so we know we're on the right track. But we're always there, like, to push the envelope. So anybody that has ideas, please share them with me. I'm always open for new ideas and improvements.
Oh, that's great. So you take a lot of feedback as people are trying Green Slice. Veronique, we talked about taste. We talked about consistency. There's also appearance. And one product that I love the look of is the Vegeroni, which is the organic vegan pepperoni. But how important is appearance in getting people to try this product in the first place?
I think it's of utmost importance. Definitely if you can't sway them with all the fancy coupons or everything that the big brands have to pull you in. My only opportunity is when you stare at my product, and in a split second, you will decide whether you like it or not. So look was truly important. So for us, we wanted the product to look good. If it doesn't look good, it's never going to taste good. Even if it tastes good, but it doesn't look good, it still won't taste good. So we wanted to focus on that. And then we also focused on the packaging. We wanted to give it that clean, fresh look and also make it look like a deli item. So you know that what you're eating is not, again, that alternative. Like, I want to eat something that I can't have. So now I really want you to feel like I'm eating deli. And that's why in a lot of places our foods are actually sold in the deli section as well.
Now, when you first developed these products and started marketing them, I could imagine that there were some long pauses, as you said, and here's our mixed garden oven roasted vegan turkey. So how did you break through or climb over those walls that had to have been in your way to get, you know, supermarket chains to say, okay, we'll stock that. Yeah, I think this is something our customers would be looking for.
It was a lot of trial and error, and actually pre-Corona, when you could do a lot of tastings in stores, I would do tastings all day long and ask feedback from people and listen to them. And based on what they were saying, I knew what I needed to tweak based on how they would call the products. I think when we started, it didn't even have the word deli slices on it. It was we were trying to figure out how to name it, but then over time and tweaking the packaging, we finally felt like this is the right way to go.
Do you have a favorite product of Green Slice?
Yes, the applewood smoked is my absolute favorite, and definitely now on a grilled cheese sandwich or on a croissant. I love it.
Now, are currently all the products pre-sliced, pre-packaged like that?
Yes. Everything is pre-sliced. Yes.
And do you see a time?
Ready to eat.
Do you see a time when they could be sliced at the deli?
I see a time. We already get requests for that. It's something that we're working on, and it's something that the Bolton warehouse, we have big plans for it. It's something that will help us in the future in achieve that.
Oh, that's fantastic. Didn't mean to kind of get ahead of it, but it just dawned on me that that could be the very next step. Now, are all the products still made in Belgium and then distributed here in Bolton?
Yes, for now they are, and then we will start shipping them out of Bolton, but the plans are in the work to start producing here.
Oh, that's fantastic.
And there's actually I'm working with farms in the area ready to develop new products. So that's where it's really going to get fun in the future. So to work with other Vermont companies and develop new products completely from start to finish here. And I think that is a couple of years away, mm-hmm. but you got to start somewhere. And I am just excited that I was able to get so far just from a bootstrapped approach, and that my customers were forgiven and the mistakes I've made on the packaging before and all the feedback that they've given me for being so vocal. And I think I thank them for them. I wouldn't be here if it wasn't for them.
Well, it's interesting. You talk about, you know, missteps and the struggles, but you still have such great enthusiasm for what, you know, is happening with the product and the future. So I would imagine you're seeing, you know, several steps ahead of where this can go.
Yes, and I think a lot of other people are seeing it too. I think it's we're not here to take away meat, to say, hey, you no longer should eat meat. We are more coming from a perspective from we don't have to eat meat all the time. But then when you're not eating it, what should I eat? And I want to make it easier at the dinner table for the whole family to rally around something, a meal that is not meat-based. Or I want to make it easier for moms that now a lot of moms, their kids come home and they say, I want to save the polar bear so I no longer eat meat. Yeah. It's hard now all of a sudden to pull out a meal when their entire life they've been eating meat. So this is a great way just to reduce your intake of meat. See how far you want to take it. Everybody's body is different. But I'm just excited that I get to provide something for families so the whole family can enjoy dinner together. And it doesn't matter what dietary constraints they have. They can all rally it behind a product that is good for you, good for your for the environment, and good for Vermont now because a lot of fun things are happening. So.
Yeah. Well, you mentioned Vermont, and earlier you mentioned Shaw's. So are your products now available in the Shaw's in Vermont?
Yes, and they've just been on the shelves for a couple of weeks, so this is brand new, and I've been checking them out on the shelf to see how sales are going. And so far, it looks like people are enjoying it because it's moving. And I am really appreciative of the time you're giving me on the radio. This is my first live radio.
Oh, no kidding.
It's fun. So to tell people that Green Slice is at Shaw's, or people can also go to other stores they shop at and say, hey, please carry Green Slice because we love this brand, women-owned company, Vermont-based company. So it's fun. There's so much to be excited about.
Where else in the country have you been able to get Green Slice into stores?
So one of our big retailers is Sprouts Farmers Market. There are about 300 stores all across the U.S. So you can go find Green Slice in Texas, in Florida, in California. And, yeah, so it's Hawaii. We're in Hawaii.
Oh, my goodness. Oh, that's very exciting. Now, there's there's another product, and we have a couple minutes to talk about this. I think you're still involved with, and it's not a food product, but a beverage called Genever. Tell us about that.
Cool. That was one of my first endeavors when I moved to Vermont. When 11 years ago, I decided to start my liquor importing company and start my own liquor brand. And so basically, everybody is aware of gin, but the history of gin goes way further than that. The grandfather of gin is Genever. It's basically a beverage that the British loved so much, couldn't pronounce the name Genever, so they dubbed it gin. Also couldn't figure out how to make it, so gin tastes very different of Genever. But I started importing that to the U.S., realized a lot of people didn't know what it was, so I ended up writing a book. So by just by accident, I guess, I became a published author of Geneva, 500 years of history in a bottle. So that was a fun little adventure. The liquor was in top cocktail stores around the U.S., but with COVID, we got hit really, really hard. So this is something that I'm going to have to leave behind. And my new focus now is Green Slice.
Exactly. Green Slice and working on new products possibly being produced here in Bolton. So some exciting news going to be coming out of Green Slice. But the most recent, now available at Shaw's Supermarkets. Wonderful that that's happened for you, Veronique. Veronique Beitel is the owner of Green Slice. You can learn more about the company and their products at greenslicefoods.com. Veronique, thank you so much for being on the show this morning.
Thank you. I appreciate it. And I wish everybody an awesome day.
All right. You take care. Boy, we got to tap her energy. That is fantastic. All right, let's take a break for top of the hour CBS News update, and then we're going to head off to Orwell to do some glass blowing. And a reminder, coming up this morning at 11 o'clock, it's Common Sense Radio. That's followed by the Midday News Service. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV.
Warren Village is a picture-perfect snow globe this time of year. We invite you to visit us at the almost world-famous Warren store. Come for breakfast, lunch, or après-ski. Have a signature deli sandwich, a hearty soup, or a specialty coffee drink paired with a sweet treat from our incredible bakery. Upstairs is a cornucopia of delightful and unique finds from men's, women's, and children's clothing to gifts, toys, games, jewelry, hats, gloves, and scarves. Best one-stop shopping in Vermont, according to Yankee Magazine. Fun, funky, safe, and friendly. Warren Store, Main Street, Warren Village, and warrenstore.com.
We're back on Vermont Viewpoint. I know social media is bad unless it's used for good. Now, a friend of mine posted a photo of her and her son spending time in Orwell blowing glass. Add to grabbing a sandwich from Buxton's General Store, sitting on the quaint town green, visiting Mount Independence, seeking out that American Gothic painted on the side of a barn, and visiting the Jersey cows that are the source for the amazing butter from Animal Farm. Add that all to the list of what you can do when visiting the absolutely charming Addison County town of Orwell to blowing glass at Orwell Glass. It makes for a great outing. Orwell Glass is where my friends spent their time that day, and when I checked it out, I also learned about the company there called Hub Consolidated and stumbled onto the beautiful creations of John Childs Glass. Turns out, I only need one guest to learn about all three of these. Joining me now is John Childs. John, welcome to Vermont Viewpoint.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Great having you. Listeners, to ask John about all things glass, you can call us at 802-244-1777 or 877-291-8255. You can email vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. John, when and why did you get into glass blowing?
Oh, I started making glass in 1980 at a small community college down in Pennsylvania. I had moved there after high school to stay with my grandmother, who wasn't doing very well, needed a little help. And I was living in San Diego. My parents were moving back to the East Coast. My dad's in the Navy, so I moved back and stayed with her and went to the community college. They had a glass blowing program. I took a class. I started working for the guy that ran the program and then got a job in a little factory and just kept at it for years, actually.
Well, what is it, John, about creating from glass that you really enjoy and look forward to doing?
Oh, boy. It's just fun. It's really fun making. I've made stuff my whole life, and so making stuff out of glass is fun. It's unique. Right? It's warm. So, I just really like making stuff.
Well, of course, warm now would be today would be a perfect day to blow glass. I'm not sure in the heat of the summer you want all that warmth. But explain a little bit about what's happening during that glass blowing process.
So we usually start out with a drawing or an idea of what we're going to make. Then the glass is melted in the furnace. It's mostly sand, but there's a little soda ash as a flux in there and some other chemicals to make it clear or color it or whatever we're trying to do at that time. When the glass is melted in the furnace, we take it out on a blowpipe, which is just a hollow tube, and shape it into whatever we're doing. Sometimes we use mold, sometimes we just freehand shape things.
Now,
it's a little bit different, so.
Yeah. How hot is that glass that you're forming?
Well, in the furnace, when we take it out of the furnace to work it, it's usually around 2000, 2050. But to melt the sand, it gets up to around 2350.
Then. Wow. And then how long do you have while the glass is still pliable? When you've taken it out of that oven, that furnace, you know, how long to blow, to form, to shape it, you know, while it's still in that kind of, I want to say, almost like liquid phase that you can work with it? Or molten?
It cools down pretty fast, and you want to keep it hot. It's a lot easier to work with if you keep it hot. If you let it get cold and then try to heat it back up, it's not as hot, evenly hot, as it was when it first came out of the furnace. So take it out of the furnace, do a little shaping, maybe add a little bit of air, blow it up a little bit, then heat it back up. It's pretty quick. It's like blacksmithing, you know. It's hot, you shape it, heat it back up, shape it, heat it back up, shape it. It's usually, I don't know, maybe 15, 20 seconds, then heat it back up for 20, 30 seconds, work on it some more. And then it also depends on the size and the thickness of what you're working on, so thin things cool down much faster than big, thick things.
Mm-hmm.
Just sort of depends on what you're working on, how long you have to work on it. It's constantly reheating, shaping, reheating, shaping.
And the blowing, what is that doing? Is that going into the glass and expanding it? What is the idea behind the blowing?
Yeah, so it's most things that are tabletop ware, like vases and bowls and that kind of thing, start out as bubbles. So it's just like if you had a balloon on the end of a tube. But you start out by taking what's called a blowpipe. It's just a hollow tube as a mouthpiece on one end and a head on the other end. So you go in and get some glass out of the furnace. It's like getting honey out of a honey pot with a honey dipper.
Mm-hmm.
Turn, 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 and the glass gathers on the end of the blowpipe. And then you shape it. And then you can blow it up, just like blowing up a bubble.
Wow.
Then go get some more glass on top of that after it's cooled down and keep adding glass to it depending on what you're making. So if you're making a Christmas ball, maybe you'd get one gather of glass and blow it up and make a ball. Or if you're making a big vase, maybe you'd go back to the furnace and get two or three gathers or four gathers depending on how big whatever you're making is.
Mm.
But the blowing is inflating that bubble into the shape that you want. So sometimes we'll use a mold, like I said, we'll use a mold that'll make the shape of whatever we're looking for. Sometimes we'll just blow it up, get it hot, and shape it with tools.
Tell us about Orwell Glass. This is how can people actually learn to do what you do?
Okay, the thing with Orwell Glass is, making stuff out of glass is really fun, right?
Right.
And people always want to try it. So what we did is we set up so that there were weekends during the year where we'll do sort of like a flash sale. We'll just send out notifications to our email address, and, hey, we're doing it. And then people call up and sign up, and we do it with slots. So
mm-hmm.
It's a 20-minute slot. People sign up, and they'll come and make. We just did Christmas balls because it was Christmas time. So everybody came, made a Christmas ball and a sun catcher. and then they can pick them up the next day, or we ship them to them. But the whole idea of Little Robots is just making it accessible to people in a simple way. We don't necessarily teach classes that are scheduled on a regular basis. We do it for Christmas. We did it for Halloween this year. We've done Valentine's Day. We make hearts. And sort of what we can schedule in the rest of the things that we have going on. If we have time, then we do it. We usually always try to do it around Christmas because it's a great thing for families to do.
Oh, absolutely. Now, John, I also understand people can kind of bring, you can bring this to an event and have people take part. How does that work? What kind of events have you been hired to do those kind of things?
So we have a furnace that's portable. So we've done, COVID has really slowed us down, right?
Sure.
So I think the last one we did was we did an event for one of the breweries in Burlington. And we set it up so that anybody could make a sun catcher. So we had a bunch of presses. It's just a disc that has a design carved into it. Mm-hmm. And we get some glass out of the furnace, put it on a metal table, and then the customer can just press their sun catcher. And then we ship them to them the next day. So but the idea with that is that we'd be able to go to team building exercises or just parties or weddings. We haven't really done that much of it. We did set up at the Maritime Museum before COVID. During the summer, we had set up at the Maritime Museum where people could sign up and come and make things. And that was running all summer. We haven't done that the last two summers, and I don't think we're going to do it again this summer. We're hoping to do it next summer.
All right. John, let's talk about John Childs Glass. This is another of your businesses. These are your creations, and I'm not even sure, they're just glass designs. They are true works of art. First of all, what are some of the things that you create that people can purchase?
The things that are on the website are all available. A lot of what we're doing nowadays for glass is lighting parts and pieces that are special items that architects need. So we also do like repair things when somebody's got something that's broken and they need it, a replacement. But then the other thing we do is from those projects we save all of the scrap glass. And we remelt it and add color to it and then sell that locally as affordable things. These are nice things to have, like bowls and vases, pitchers, things that are just general things that people need in their houses, you know?
Mm-hmm.
But the stuff on the website is more aimed at the decorative market.
And John, you're almost downplaying those pieces that are on your website. I'll take the goblets, for instance, which are so exquisite. I don't know. I'd be worried for anyone to actually use them as a goblet. Do people buy them and just display them as art pieces, keep them in a china closet?
Yeah, there's people. There's people that have huge goblet collections. So a lot of that stuff is made for that market, right? The goblet collection. In fact, that's a pretty special market, those goblets, yeah. Those goblets were made for a show at the American Craft Museum probably 15 years ago.
Mm. They are stunning. How would you describe the style of art that typifies your personal creations?
Well, that's a tricky question.
There's no wrong answer, John.
Yeah, I know. No, it's American craft, really. It's American craft. It's design work that's So it's inspired by my experiences in the world and people that I run into, things that happen. So, you know, because I work with glass, I have times where I can do whatever I want, and that's what those pieces are all about. This is what I would like to see if I could make anything I wanted. And a lot of art is just sort of creating an environment or an object or a sense or feeling of how I would like it to be if I could stop time and present what I saw.
Mm-hmm. Well, there's so many beautiful things on your website. There are the lightning, snake tail, and root bottles, which, again, when I see them, I'm just arrested by their beauty. Can you explain, you know, that stunning collection to people?
Well, that's really about sort of stopping moments in time, but this is what it would be if there was a record of that happening, but nobody had that experience, and they could go pick it up and say, oh, that's what lightning looked like,
mm-hmm.
or that's what a root looked like. And that was sort of the idea when I was making those. Yeah.
Now, I want to talk about the third company that you're involved with, and this is Hub Consolidated. So what does the company produce?
So Hub Consolidated, mostly what I do there is help people that want to make glass, something out of glass, figure out what they need to do it, figure out the process, and then what equipment they need to do it, and then we produce the equipment for that. So when I first started out, I was working in a small factory in Pennsylvania, and I had an opportunity to go up to a school up in Maine called Haystack and work with an Italian master that had come over and was sort of teaching Italian techniques to Americans in this country. This was back in the mid-80s, I think. And at that point, the equipment that people were using in small-scale glass manufacturing was sort of homemade, home-built stuff. It was pretty funky, wasn't really taking advantage of what was available for sort of a commercial, industrial type of application. And working with that Italian master, he talked to me a lot about how furnaces should be, and reheating furnaces, and annealing ovens, and just things, the equipment that's in a glass shop, how it should be, and not necessarily what was wrong with what was going on over here, but what would make it better. And so, like you said before, it's hot in a glass shop, so we would typically shut down in the summer and do our equipment building during that period, not making glass. And so people got wind of the fact that I had that kind of information and was building stuff, and so that business kind of took off on its own. And in between working in the factory, I'd go build equipment for people, and then that business just really took off by itself. And so, yeah.
So for those furnaces, are they basically custom built, or do you construct the furnaces there in Orwell and then ship them? How's that done, John?
Yeah, everything is custom built. So if you went to the Hub Glass website, there's a list of equipment and stuff that you could just buy if you wanted to. But nobody ever really does that. They look at it and they say, I really like that, but I want it to be left-handed, not right-handed.
Right.
Okay. Or we need to make these, and we need to make this number of these, and they need to be this color, and which one of these do you think would be the best one for us to use? So then ask them a bunch of questions and work it out and decide what they want. So it's all built to order. Very rarely is something built that's just as it's described in the, on the website or the catalog. And then we ship it all. We ship equipment all over the world. Last year we shipped 2 containers to Egypt. This is kind of crazy. But all over the world with customers in Europe, Asia, all over the place.
Incredible. Now, John, the glassware you produce takes an amazing artistic sense. The furnaces, a mechanical mind. So we're talking left brain, right brain. And are you one of those people comfortable in operating in both universes?
I guess so, yeah. I don't really look at it like it's two different universes. I mean, it's all a process, right? So I just look at it like, okay, I need to go do that now. Yeah.
And the creation of glass from sand, you know, is that, you know, a more chemical process than artistic, at least to begin with, that we, you know?
Oh, yeah. So to melt glass, what most people in this country do is buy it already mixed. And actually, what's happening more and more so is not only is it already mixed, it's already melted, so it's coming into the glass shop in bags or barrels of, it's called cullet, so it's just chunks of glass.
Mm.
So most glass blowers in this country, actually most countries nowadays that are small scale, either bring it in as cullet, which is chunks of glass that have already been melted, or as what's called batch, which is the raw materials all mixed together, and you shovel it in the furnace. It's really just a big chemistry project, right? The sand,
right.
The sand is not beach sand, right? Because beach sand is coral and dead fish. It's silica sand, quartz silica sand. So that has a really high melting temperature, like up around 3,000 or 3,200, which is hotter than most people's furnaces can get with just the propane and natural gas and forced air.
Mm.
So there's a flux at it. So it works the same way as throwing salt on ice. It changes the melting temperature, right? So
right. You
put a flux in with the silica, and that lowers the melting temperature of the silica, and then you can melt it in a conventional furnace. So like, lead is a, everybody knows about lead glass, right? So lead was a flux. But it also made the glass brighter and denser, clearer. But most of the glass that we're surrounded with nowadays is soda lime glass. So soda, which is just ash. In fact, when I first got involved with the Maritime Museum, one of the guys there gave me an article about the first glass shop that was in Burlington. And actually, it was an article about...
Oh, John, we're going to have to end it right there. I want to hear that story some other time. John Childs is owner of Orwell Glass, John Childs Glass, and Hub Construction, and you can find links to all of them at orwellglass.com. John, thank you so much for your time this morning.
You have a great day. Thank you.
All right, you too. All right, we're going to take a break for CBS News, and we'll be back to open up the phones until 11. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV.
Warren Village is a picture-perfect snow globe this time of year. We invite you to visit us at the almost world-famous Warren store. Come for breakfast, lunch, or après-ski. Have a signature deli sandwich, a hearty soup, or a specialty coffee drink paired with a sweet treat from our incredible bakery. Upstairs is a cornucopia of delightful and unique finds from men's, women's, and children's clothing to gifts, toys, games, jewelry, hats, gloves, and scarves. Best one-stop shopping in Vermont, according to Yankee Magazine. Fun, funky, safe, and friendly. Warren Store, Main Street, Warren Village, and warrenstore.com.
Welcome back to Vermont Viewpoint. All right, we've got open phones until 11. Not sure I have a ton of stuff for you if you don't call. Uh-oh. So you better call. 802-244-1777, 877-291-TALK. That's 877-291-8255. You can email vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. I was out in 1 degree weather yesterday, and it chilled me to the bone. I've been extreme sledding up on top of Lincoln Gap, and it was zero, and I was as warm as could be. Now, of course, you hike up to the top, and you've got the protection of the trees up there. That may be why it was a bit warmer. Sometimes there's just more moisture in the air. So I wondered, what's the coldest that you've experienced here in Vermont or elsewhere? I can remember my coldest day in Vermont, although I do subscribe to that theory. I guess I've learned it here that that once it goes below zero, it's all the same. The other thing about when it's below zero, the snow has that very specific crunching sound. It almost squeaks when you step on it, right? Isn't that wild? All right, so my coldest day, I'll tell you about that in a moment. And the other thing I wondered about, if you're a farmer, the animals in the barns, how do they handle it? It doesn't get as cold in a barn for some reason. I'm sure there's heat from the cows, but fan systems, what do you use? I'd love to know about that. All right, here's another thing that I'll mention. I drove back to Pennsylvania over Christmas, and everybody, it's like in Pennsylvania or south of us, it felt like everybody had just washed their car. I never saw so many clean cars in my life in the dead of winter. And everybody commented about how dirty my car was. It was filthy in comparison. I got back up here. I washed it within seconds. It's all covered with salt and dirt, and it feels good again. But I look around, and we drive very dirty cars. And when you drive outside of Vermont, you drive south down into like the mid-Atlantic, all their roads are paved, so they don't have the dirt roads we have. They don't have as much snow early on in the season. So anyway, all right, let's go to Ted in Shelburne. Always great hearing from Ted. How are you, Ted?
Oh, I'm good. A lot of buttons being pushed here. One is I did used to live on a dirt road.
And so of course.
And I see you once in a while, even though now I live on pavement in Shelburne. But you see some of the real folk come in with dirt-caked cars.
Yeah.
Another curiosity. The old squire, a couple of mornings ago, he did a thing about people making... cedar oil, I think, and which explained the process beautifully. Like it's a way of steaming and like a distillery sort of getting the water and oil and then separating so you just get the oil. And I remember something. As you are driving toward Hardwick from Woodbury, I guess that's Route 14, before you get to go up a bit of a rise into the real Hardwick, on the right there's a field, and there used to be something I remember hearing about it. This would be in the 60s, as balsam oil.
Oh, interesting.
Making. But anyhow, if anybody can fill in some more of that, that would be an intriguing bit of Vermont interest, and if there's anything like that going on now. And also, I was a glass blower in a small degree. As a potter, the one appeal of glass blowing is that the next day you've got what you got.
Right.
As a potter, first it's wet, then it's dry, then it's trimmed or dryer trimmed, bisque fired, and then a whole batch of glazing that goes over months. And with glass, if you have the furnace, and I bought a furnace from a fellow in New Hampshire, Dudley Giberson. And I hurt my shoulder one winter as this was going on, and I drove down to Mexico in my Dodge van, and seeing is what you need to do, as the description was coming over the radio, and also his website gives you a lot of interesting pictures. But
yeah.
And so I watched a lot of glass blowing, and it wasn't very expensive. I bought enough to mostly fill the van, which kind of paid off the trip when I got back. And I got through customs okay. I had appropriate paperwork.
Oh, wow.
Because the van was packed. It would have been quite something if we had to lay it out in a gym floor and make sure there were no illegal substances.
All right.
Anyhow, and it's a team sport, and that's where my failing sort of is. I usually figure stuff out and do it. Till I'm done, but I don't call for help.
Right.
And because that glass, which is like keeping the honey on the spoon, if you stop turning it, you drop it.
Oh, right, like a big,
you know, pencil. And so it's constantly in motion, and so, and I did some things okay, and I made a stand with bearings so I could, you know, do it solo to a degree. Also, as you're blowing that bubble, if you want a bowl or anything, actually, mostly, you need to get it off of the, you need to get the bubble hitched to the another stick with glass on it, on the bottom of it. And then you break it off the blowpipe, and then you've got an open hole that you can stretch out and do what you're doing with. Anyhow, it's quite a... But the next day, then it can't cool quickly. You have to keep it hot, and then you put it... I had an old pottery kiln kind of electric that I put it in at maybe 1,100 degrees after it's finished, when you take it off the pontle, it's called... that has you stuck to the center of the bottom, and then it has to cool from, say, 1,100 degrees slowly overnight. But indeed, the thing that you make one day, you have to use or sell or whatever it's done the next day is through its complete process, and that's one of the appeals to those of us who are accustomed to flames and fire and making things while they're turning.
Well, Ted, I want to ask you two questions. First of all, you mentioned the van heading to Mexico. So you took down all these items that you had created to sell down
there?
No.
I hadn't created anything. I was a wannabe glassblower.
Uh-huh.
I was learning, and I took the empty van and me and my hurt shoulder, which wasn't too good with firewood carrying upstairs and stuff. So I took an empty van down, and I watched a lot of glass blowing. I drove through Mexico City at rush hour on Friday. Remember that? And filled up the van.
For that, you should have a medal.
After watching and ordering this stuff, I'd say, oh, do this, and a bowl. I saw it my brother and sister-in-law's the other day, one of these glass bowls, which I don't have remnants of this. Maybe I have a few tumbler drinking glasses, but no. So I went down to learn. Seeing and doing is what you will is the best way to get through that first 20 minutes of description on the radio, is to watch somebody do the glass blowing. And anyhow, I related to that, and I wanted to call about those several things.
But, my next question is. Ted, is about the cedar oil and balsam oil. Again, I'm a bit of a city kid. So what was that actually used for? What would one use? Was that for scents or aroma?
The balsam, I assumed, was that, and I can't remember if the old Squire, and you could probably find that.
We'll have to dig it up.
Probably Monday. Let's see. Does he do it? Probably Monday morning early was when that came across.
Okay.
But I don't know. Like, I just noticed because I thought I had some peppermint flavoring in my kitchen, and I noticed that it was oil. But it would be with balsam. I was thinking, that's it. It's the scent of the oil that you would use to make your car smell prettier, or your outhouse, or whatever. I think it would be, and the cedar maybe the same way, and maybe it would carry some of the cedar characteristics of moth resisting or something.
Oh, right.
I'm never quite sure. I'm just intrigued by sort of how stuff works and process.
All right. Well, we'll try to learn together. So, thanks so much, Ted.
Thank you. I appreciate the time.
Oh, great talking to you. Yeah. All right. This is why we live here, though, right? It's cold, but the winter is what we love. Is there anything you love doing when it gets so brutally cold and it scares most of the other humans inside, giving you more room to play or work? I do extreme sledding. Always love getting up the mountains as early as I could before it got crowded with snow machines and cross-country skiers and dogs. How about penguin plunging? Anybody doing that? I think they are in March this year. I've done 7. They used to do one up in Newport and Bennington, but I think it's just in Burlington. But there's some smaller ones, too, more local. So let us know about that if you know it. 802-244-1777, 877-291-8255. Headed to Starksboro next. Let's talk to Rich. Hey, Rich, how you doing?
Pretty good, Rick. And you?
Good. Great to hear from you. What's up?
I got something to add about the cedar oil.
Yeah.
But I got to thank Howard Frank Mosier and Jay Craven for for what I think I understand about cedar oil.
Okay.
And it goes back to Where the Rivers Flow North, movie.
Yeah, from the book.
Where Rip Torn and his wife, I guess, Tantu Cardinal. I don't know the names of the characters.
That's all right.
The names of the actors.
Yeah, fabulous
and,
actors.
Rip Torn, during the movie, he was going out in his canoe and he was gathering cedar boughs and taking them back to this little still kind of looking thing, and he was making cedar oil in the film. And I believe that they were, you know, being in the Northeast Kingdom, they weren't electrified during the time of the movie, which is approximately during the Depression, roughly, based on kind of looking at the model of the cars. Could have been later on than that, but I don't think they were yet electrified. So I think they were using the cedar oil for their lamps.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. We call them, kerosene lamps, and where I kind of grew up in my, but oil lamps.
Yeah, you could use whale oil, and cedar oil would might make sense. Oh, that's great. Boy, you bring up Howard Frank Mosier. That's one Vermonter I miss so dearly. What a lovely man, great writer.
Me too.
Yeah. Rich, thanks for that. That's interesting to hear. So cedar oil used for lamps. All right, on to Eden we go. Brian's next. Hey, Brian, what's going on?
Hey, how are you?
Good.
I was going to call in. You were in Cabot back before Christmas.
Yes.
And I was going to call in with a kind of interesting little Cabot story or a question, but then you had so many interesting people on, and I figured I'd wait to a day it was slower.
Okay.
Then I'd give a call. Anyway, there's a place up on the hill above town. It's up above the creamery and stuff where there's a circle of trees. There's nothing up there. It's a big field, a hay field. And there's a circle of trees, and there's a graveyard up there. And it seems funny because there's almost no houses on that hill.
Mm-hmm.
And this big graveyard. And the story I heard was that used to be the center of Cabot when it first got settled. And people had so much trouble digging wells, there weren't enough springs, that they moved the whole village down into the valley.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a rather extensive graveyard up there. And my experience I had up there, I went up there twice. I went up with a girl who runs around taking photographs of old gravestones. And so we went up there, and she had an old-fashioned camera, you know, before the digital. So, you know, you wait, you get it developed, and you get it back.
Right, right.
And she didn't do her own developing. Anyway, so she showed me the photos, and there were these crazy little white lights everywhere. And I just thought it was defective film, you know, whatever. Whatever, some weird thing happened. And so we went back up there about a year later, and she took pictures, and it happened again, where there were like these little globes of white light, but they only appeared on the
film, right?
Which I just think is really cool.
Well, that's pretty interesting stuff. And if anybody from Cabot knows and would like to add to the story, we'd love to hear from you. But
yeah,
the whole idea, we'll take that first part before we get on to the spectral side of it, but. That whole idea of moving the center of town. Now, I don't know the facts about Cabot, but I do have a history book that I was given, Brian, by the Historical Society when I was there that day. So I'll try to find out what I can, and I think we'll have some time tomorrow to talk about it. But I've been to Hardwick and out in East Hardwick. And to the fellow who has the hop farm there, and he drove me around and said, you know, that kind of thing happened in Hardwick. You know, the center of town was way out, like in East Hardwick, and eventually, you know, it moved and moved and wound up where it is today. So that is not unheard of happening in Cabot. And I don't know about the haunted graveyard, but hey,
I don't know.
that's very interesting that happened, but let me, check the history book and see what I can find and probably report on it for you tomorrow. Okay.
Cool. Thanks. Yeah. I don't know if that's true. It's just what somebody around there told me.
All right.
Me, so
we'll find out. All right. Yeah, cool. We got a couple more minutes and we head to, the Duke of Newbury and Fred. Hey, Fred, what's up?
I think this voting rights is going to be a gigantic issue. Right now, we have a national identification card, but you can't use it for an ID.
Right.
So
right.
How do you think we're going to settle this voting rights? I mean, you need an ID for just about everything, right? I mean,
true,
try to get
true.
On an airplane. If you don't have the proper ID, you can't get in an airplane. And even a federal building, if you want to go into a federal building, you can't get in that building if you don't have an ID that allows you in there.
And those are both matters of security.
I know. And security is very important because you want a secure election, don't you?
We do. But, you know, it's funny because quite often when we hear legislation, you know, we'll say, well, that's, you know, legislation in pursuit of, you know, a problem. Where is the problem in voting fraud? And that's really what showing ID is kind of doing. And Fred, it goes back to poll taxes. It goes back to, you know, people who didn't have ID, you know, didn't drive, couldn't afford an automobile, and them not having that type of ID and not being able to vote, and thus making it more difficult for people of a certain economic class to vote. So that's the big issue. And, you know, some see it one way, some see it the other. You bring up the great question. It will be debated. It will be debated heavily, and we'll see where it goes. But I agree with you. This is, you know, what the president right now is really, you know, kind of pushing for, and we'll see how far it gets. But it is a major issue that's coming up and really coming out of a number of years of changing voting rights, of allowing vote by mail, and claims of fraud in the last election. All right, that'll do it for phones. Sorry we're out of time. I want to thank everyone for calling. Really interesting stuff this morning. That is our show for today. Vermont Viewpoint, directed so adroitly by Danny McGivergan. Please feel free to suggest guests, topics, or places you think we should broadcast during our 90th anniversary. As Brian mentioned, we were in Cabot at Harry's Hardware. Coming up next week, we will be in Waitsfield at the Village Grocery. So going to have a lot of fun there. You can listen to past episodes of Vermont Viewpoint by downloading our podcast at WDEVradio.com. And that is sponsored by the Warren Store, funky, friendly, and almost world famous. Common Sense Radio with Bill Sayre is up next. I'm Rick Singeri. I'll meet you back here tomorrow when we talk about the Endangered Alphabets Project.